the field, turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong.
Final furlong.
Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live. HRRN Live. It's Trainer Talk Wednesday. Now, here's Mike Pena and Jude Feld.
Welcome back, everyone, and welcome to yet another edition of Trainer Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Ed DeRosa filling in this afternoon for Jude Feld, who is he's a busy man here today working on a couple of projects. He'll be back with me tomorrow afternoon. And a very special edition of Trainer Talk coming your way over the course of the next hour. Hall of Fame trainer Shug McGahee, nice enough to spend some time with us here in the first hour, half an hour of the show. And then Buff Bradley coming with us in the second hour. So it should be a lot of fun. Really looking forward to this edition of Trainer Talk live from our HRRN studios here in Lexington, Kentucky. And we do welcome all of you tuning in coast to coast on Sirius XM satellite radio, Sirius 93, XM 209. Internet smartphone channel 961. Without further ado, Shug McGahee waiting on the line up in New York. And Shug, we certainly appreciate you taking a little bit of time to spend with us here this afternoon.
Okay, well, thanks. I'm here.
And all the folks here in Lexington, very familiar with you, Shug. Of course, a native of Lexington, Kentucky, inducted into Racing's Hall of Fame in 2004. And Shug, you knew pretty early on that you wanted to be in this business. So let's start from the beginning and talk about the early days and being introduced to the sport.
Well, being from Lexington, you know, I was introduced to the sport through my parents taking me to Keeneland. My family really had no attachment to horse racing whatsoever. And, you know, but they, as a young guy, they'd take me out to Keeneland, you know, and we'd bet on something to show and this and that. And as I got older and got where I could drive, I'd go out there myself, and you know, my interest just kind of waned from there, and you know, kind of piddled around. Walt Robertson and his brother Jimmy were friends of mine and kind of showed me around the saddle horse business a little bit locally, and you know, worked at Tattersall Sale one time, and you know, and then I was in college, and probably around 1971 or so, I drew a high draft lottery number, and I asked my parents if I could stay out a semester, and they said yes, but you need to get a job. So I went over to Keeneland, and David Carr was a friend of mine or an acquaintance of mine. His brother-in-law at that time named Sammy Cottrell was a classmate of mine, and I think his wife was my teacher. And so I started working for him, working at Keeneland, you know, just as a hot walker, and it was during the off season in the summertime, and it just kind of went from there.
Is that the point when you realized that you wanted to make this more than just take it from being a fan and actually be in the game and do more with it and work within the industry?
Well, no doubt. It was, you know, it became more as a fan. It was, I never was really big on school. You know, it was kind of just sort of a thing to do for me. But when I got to the racetrack and started seeing and learning and what all I was learning and seeing every day, you know, I just became infatuated with it, you know, something I really like. So, you know, getting up and going to work in the morning and learning and staying all day. And I wanted to be with the black, when the blacksmith was there, and be there when the vet was there. And, you know, I learned from the guys around there that were grooms then. And, you know, they teach you how to put the bandages on, how to pick their feet, put the tack on them and all that kind of stuff. And it was just, it became, you know, just quite an experience for me. And, you know, I enjoyed going to the races. So in between the morning work and the afternoon work, especially if we were at the races, you know, I was able to go to the races. So it was, you know, it was just, not only was it quite a learning experience, but it was a lot of fun too.
Shug, early on or even now, would you say you get your satisfaction from knowing you're leading over a horse who's ready to run, or do you get the most satisfaction when you lead him into the winner's circle?
No, you know, I mean, it's fun for me to train. The running them in the afternoon is just kind of the end result. You know, I think probably some of the most exciting things are when you have a 2-year-old that you think can run, and you take them over there, you know, that's probably the most exciting time for me to see how they perform, and some perform well, some will disappoint, but you know, all aspects of winning is fun. I don't care, you know, at what level it is, you know. I mean, obviously, when you point a horse to the big races, and they get there and they do perform well and are able to win, you know, that's the ultimate thrill. You know, but that day, you know, you build yourself up so much. For me, you know, it's almost like when it's over, it's thank goodness it's over. Because I still get nervous. You know, the nervousness might be for 2 or 3 days. And so by the time you get to race time, you've built yourself up to such a high that, you know, it's when it's over with, it's thank goodness it's over with. And, you know, and back, you know, when I was younger and first started with the Fitzes, and we were having, you know, all the success we were having, you know, a lot of my friends would say, I can't believe you're not more excited, you know, when maybe we'd meet after the races for dinner and stuff. And, you know, basically it was more of a letdown than, I mean, obviously I was excited and inside and thrilled and proud and, you know, everything else you can say, but, you know, it was sort of a letdown, too, but, you know, I really enjoy training in the morning, and, you know, I got a nice bunch of people around me now, and that have been here, and that I understand. They understand me, and you know, so going out in the morning on most mornings, not all of them, but most mornings, it's you know, it's fun for me.
Shug, interesting to hear you say that you still get nervous. I mean, with all the wins that you've amassed and all the championships, you would think that it would become somewhat old hat, but you can't replace that feeling when those horses are going into the gate. And I think that's something that gets us all hooked on the sport. And interesting to say that still kind of gets you inside when those the days and the moments coming up to a big race.
Well, you know, I mean, I think if you don't get nervous, you probably ought not be doing it. But, you know, when I went to work for the Phippses, Mr. Phipps was, you know, well up into the 70s and, you know, was pretty fluid up until, you know, really his late 80s. And, you know, I could see him still getting nervous, you know, whether it was a stake race or, you know, maybe a first time starter maiden 2-year-old that, you know, would obviously that he'd bred and raised and put the thought into it. And, you know, he might show up for that race, you know, 2 or 3 races in advance. And, you know, and he would still, you know, I could see him get nervous and I could see him get thrilled. And when he had a cane, he would take that cane as they were running and be popping it on the ground, kind of his way of cheering them on. And so all that he went through in his life, if I don't still get nervous, then there's something that's wrong at my age.
Well, Shug, that's been an amazing relationship with the Phipps. You mentioned started training for them in 1985, and the rest is history. And over the course of the past, well, almost 3 decades now, that relationship is still intact. What is it about the relationship that's allowed for such longevity and success?
Well, I mean, obviously, I think that the little bit of success we've had has obviously helped us along a whole lot. But, you know, the Phippses and Stuart Janney and people like Helen Alexander and her sister Emery that I've had horses for a long time, they're just, you know, they're genuine people, and they're not people that want to skip around just because maybe things that don't go right. But really, with my relationship with the Phippses, and people have asked me that question before, and I think that the biggest thing is, you know, that over the years, I've tried to be honest with them, and you know, in all aspects of what I do. And it's more than, you know, in this job, it's more than just training. You know, I mean, it's kind of a full-fledged operation, and I sort of run it, except for the breeding part of it and the part that Claiborne Farm does. I do help with the breeding, but, you know, that's basically, you know, Mr. Phipps now and Seth Hancock, and the, you know, what goes on at Claiborne Farm is, Claiborne's Farms business, and they got a great crew out there now, their farm manager and Bradley and some of the others that are around that you know, are sending us the horses the best that they can possibly send them to, but I send them to, and, you know, but I've developed, you know, a lot of, like, our relationship with Niall Brennan over the last 3 or 4 years has been been a very good one in our breaking process, and, you know, in our layup and that type of a thing. And, you know, I just think that, but basically I think that, you know, over the years that I've tried to be as honest with the Phippses and Stuart Janney and my other clients as well, as I possibly could. And I've also tried to be very selective in anybody that I brought in there that was, you know, that I might have a horse for that would be the same way. You know, I mean, I haven't got horses, but for, you know, maybe 2 or 3, 4 outside people. But, you know, like I say, it's Helen Alexander and her sister Emery, who owned Hungry Island and finished third there the other day. And a longtime friend of mine, Andrew Rosen, that's, you know, he's also friends with the Phippses and the Phipps family. And, you know, he's the same way. He's, you know, he's a genuine guy. And, you know, we've been not only been friends, but, you know, I've had some horses for him the last few years.
Being honest can definitely be tough when it's bad news. Can you think of throughout your career a phone call that you really dreaded having to make to Mr. Phipps or the family? You know, an instance where it was really difficult to have to deliver bad news about a horse that may have been a favorite of theirs or something along those lines.
Well, obviously, over the years, you know, there's been a lot of phone calls that I don't want to make, and it's tough making a phone call. It's not only tough when something happens to one of them, you know, and we've had that, you know, obviously we've had that over the years, whether it was a breakdown or sick or, you know, a horse running bad, but, you know, I don't like that. I mean, when one of them doesn't run good, I'm not, you know, it's not easier for me to pick up the telephone and call them and try to explain, hey, now, when you tell them that's the last you hear of it, whether it's, you know, whether it's tragic or whether it's just a horse running bad. But I guess probably the most interesting one was that in 1987 or 86, first Linson and broke her maiden, her first start. And she ran the same time as they ran the matron that same day, going 7/8 of a mile. So I ran in and nominated her to the Presette, which was in 2 weeks. And so we decided to run her there, and she was able to win, but she was all out to win. And when she came out of that race, she was just training unbelievable to go to the Breeders' Cup at Santa Anita. And this is when she was a 2-year-old. And the Sunday before she was going to leave on Monday, I breezed her. She went fantastic, 5/8 like in a minute. Watched her cool out. She cooled out fine. I went back over to my office. I remember it was a cold day and probably the end of October. And Buzzy, my assistant, came over and said, you know, you better come look at this. And, she, you know, she couldn't walk. And so we got, you know, veterinarian over at X-ray, and she had a fracture in her back pastern. And so I had to call, you know, Mr. Phipps and tell him. And I remember he came to the barn, you know, shortly afterwards, and we came up with a plan of attack. And so that was obviously a phone call. And I was younger in my relationship there, and I obviously didn't cherish making, but, you know, they took it well. And, you know, we got her back to the races, and the rest was history.
Shug, when you look back, sticking with personal Ensign, when you look back at her and her career and you look back on it now, what are some of the things that come to mind that you remember and remember fondly about her?
Well, I can remember every race, to tell you the truth. You know, I remember when she broke her maiden, and I remember when she won the Present and how well she trained after that. She beat a filly of Scottish Shule offers called Collins that day on all track. And then when we brought her back as a 3-year-old, funny story about her. Had a real good exercise boy at the time. He didn't get on her, named Bob Witham. It was really a good horseman, an English guy, rode jumpers. And I'd gotten her ready to run at Saratoga as a 3-year-old. back coming off her injury, and I said, I better work her out of gate. And I took her over there, and I worked her out of gate, and he was her work partner, and he didn't know who she was. And so we worked, and I asked him, I said, Bob, how'd that horse go? And he said, he went good, but he said, this horse that I went with, so she's a monster, and it was her. Now she's ready to run. She's a two other than, and put her in a two other than, didn't go, and so I ended up running her out of conditions in a three other than, and it ended up being a pretty tough three other than, and she won, but she's still eligible for three other than. So Tommy Skipton was a friend of mine. He had a filly in the race, and he said, I'm glad to get your filly out of the way. Maybe my filly can win three other than next time. Well, I kept my mouth shut, and first Lenson showed up in the next three other than with Tommy Skipton's filly helping fill the race. We were able to win again, and you know, then she won the Rare Perfume and the Beldame. But one of the things I'm getting to is she won those four races in about in less than less than 30 days. And I mean, you just hardly ever see that anymore. And the Beldame she'd run, you know, that was against older fillies. That was the first time. And then bring her back off a 7 month layoff, 8 month layoff, and she ran in a grade one then as a 4 year old in the shoe beat. And she won that, and she won the Beldame really easy. And I was getting some feedback from, there was a pretty good filly on the West Coast that, you know, Shug's filly can't win any place in Belmont Park. So I said, well, I'll take care of that. So we took her down, ran her into Molly Pitcher and Mammoth, and she won that really easy. And then, oh, man, Mr. Phipps and myself decided that maybe we ought to run her into Whitney. And so we took her to the Whitney and ran her in the, up there in the slop against Gulch and King Swan, and she was able to win that. And I was going to bring her back and run her in the Ruffian, which was a handicap at the time. And I got to look around, and the Masquette was running in, was going a mile, and it was a weight yourself race where she wouldn't have to carry as much weight as it was a handicap. So I ran her in there. And Winning Colors, unbeknownst to me, Winning Colors showed up in there. And so now we got her running against the Derby winner going a mile. And I was I put another filly in there called Cadillacking, and I was going to kind of use her as a rabbit. She'd won the Ballerina up there that summer. I remember Canaro was riding Cadillacking, and he called me in the paddock about the third race and said, Wayne's raising Kane over me riding this rabbit. And I said, well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to scratch the rabbit. And they left there, Winning Colors about five in front, and I was kicking myself. I said, boy, you sure did the wrong thing here, but we were able to catch her and win. And then she won the Beldame easy and went to the Breeders' Cup thinking that, you know, we had the nuts and got her there, everything was fine. And, you know, I went over there that afternoon expecting sort of the same performance that we've been getting, but it didn't happen, you know. And really she didn't handle the track at all, and Winning Colors loved it, and as well as Goodbye Halo, who were two very, very, very good horses, the Derby winner and the Oaks winner. And at the last part of it, she sort of got a hold of it and got to running and, you know, was able to get up and win. You know, she went home 13 for 13 and, you know, the first champion in 80-some-odd years, and the last one that had been retired undefeated.
Well, Shug, she was certainly a very special filly, and I know it holds a very special place in your heart. I tell a lot of people this story that when I first got hooked on racing, I grew up in Western Massachusetts in Pittsfield, so my home track was Saratoga. And I can remember the first time I actually remember really going to the races was in 1989 and the Traverse Stakes. And I'm sure I had been before with my dad, but the time I really remember was being there for Easy Goer, and he instantly became my favorite horse. He's the horse responsible for getting me to where I am now, because he hooked me on the sport. So I blame Easy Goer for all of this.
Well,
but what a horse. I mean, just amazing. Yeah, look back on him.
He was very good, and he's a big reason I'm where I am. You know, the races that he won, and we were able to participate, especially at a young age, to go through the Triple Crown was, you know, hugely exciting with a horse like that, even though he got beat twice, but he was able to win the Belmont. And, you know, it was huge. And that day in the Travers, you know, he'd gotten a lot of publicity, and, you know, he was sort of the East Coast favorite. And, you know, there was a big crowd there that day, and they had assigned the security force, who I think Matt Musiker, who's Javier Castellanos' agent now, is well around there, as he had Rosie around here all summer, and who's doing well at Keeneland now. So, but he was assigned one of the guys to walk over in front of him to kind of keep the crowd away. And then we crossed across the road and went down through the picnic area there. The farther we'd go, the more the crowd would get kind of closer and closer. And, you know, it was pretty, you know, he handled it fine. He got a little bit upset in the paddock, but just playing upset. But it was just, you know, for me, I was looking, I said, you know, this is what it was all about. No matter that I was a nervous wreck, but, you know, I thought that, you know, to be a part of something like this with a horse like this is, you know, really, really, really exciting. And then to be able to go through the fall and win the Woodward and the Jockey Club Gold Cup and then go down to Florida and be a part of, you know, that Breeders' Cup Classic with he and Sunday Silence come together again. You know, I just don't know how it really gets better than that. I hope that I can maybe one day feel that thrill again, you know, at that level, and I'm sure that we will. But it was, you know, he was sure an exciting horse, and, you know, the East Coast and the public loved him, and as well as we did, and he gave Mr. Phipps his first and only classic winner, and the same with me. And, you know, like I say, to be able to participate in those kind of races or, you know, for a guy with a smaller type stable like myself, it's few and far between.
Did being involved with Personal Ensign and her undefeated championship seasons and Easy Goer and his rivalry with Sunday Silence, did you feel like you had a special perspective of what John Sheriff's and the Mosses were going through with managing Zenyatta's campaigns?
Yeah, and I was a fan of they were going on, you know, what was going on and with Zenyatta, and I was watching it. You know, I've had a relationship with Mike Smith, rode a lot of nice horses for me back in the days. And, you know, so as it was getting closer to 13, they were, you know, somehow I was starting to get some calls. And I think they were wanting me to say that, you know, I don't want her to break Personal Ensign's record, but, you know, I was a fan of Zenyatta's. I enjoyed watching her run. You know, John Sheriff, I think, is an excellent horseman. It was handled the whole thing well as the Mosses. And, you know, they owned the horse. They bought her and owned her themselves. And, you know, it wasn't like you had 150 people that owned a piece of her. And they were the ones that were calling the shots and taking the pride in her. And I thought it was all a very good scenario. And I think it was, hopefully it was, you know, a lot like, you know, what we were going through with Personal Ensign too, you know, with the people involved.
You might even see some Blaine babies in your barn since he's at Claiborne.
Well, we will. I know we bred some mares, so I'm looking forward to it. Got a nice Blaine. I know a foal out of a mare called Consequence. It was, I think she was El Prado Educator Risk that won a grass race at stake at Arlington and was second or third in the Beaumont there at Keno when she was a 3-year-old. And, you know, we're going to breed more, you know, we got more mares and foal to him and, as well as the Phippses and Stuart Janney. So yeah, we'll be well represented by Blaine.
Hall of Fame trainer Shug McGahee joining us here on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Shug, time flies, believe it or not, just a few minutes left here before we have to let you go. Buff Bradley coming up next here in the second half of the show. I do need to know, though, where did the nickname Shug come from?
I grew up with it. I'm the third, and so I've always been called that. And, you know, really, if somebody calls me Claude, they don't know who they're talking to. So, I've been Shug my whole life. I mean, everybody wants me to say my mother wanted to call me Sugar, but that wasn't it, according to her. That, you know, that was just what came up, and they had to call me something, so that was it.
Now I think you and I have a mutual acquaintance down here in Tony Attiano at the Lexus store of Lexington, and Tony had mentioned to me, he said, don't forget to ask Shug about his Lexus being broken into up in New York.
Well, they stole them.
They stole them.
I had one, and they told me when I bought it, you couldn't steal it. And I was in California at the Breeders' Cup, and I got a call from one of my guys back at the barn and said, did the service department Lexus come get your Lexus? I said, no, just parked behind my office. And it went in there, and so it had a phone in the car, so I called it, and the guy answered the phone. And I said, what'd you take my car for? And he goes, I didn't take your car, but he never answered the phone again, and they found it about a month later. And I got a thing, but I had a friend that was at work in the service department at the Lexus place here where I used to take it to get service, and I called her, and I said, I thought she said they couldn't steal these things. She said, they're stealing them all the time. Just come get you another one, so... But that was the story on that.
Off the rack.
Well, Shug, again, just a minute or two left here. We haven't even talked about this year's Breeders' Cup contenders and point of entry. Hymnbook, is Hymnbook still on the trail?
No, just point of entry would be the only one.
All right, impressive in that last outing. Look back on that for just a minute and tell us how he's doing coming up to the Breeders' Cup.
Well, I was very impressed with his race the other day because I thought he was doing something probably over a track that he wasn't all that comfortable over, being as soft as it was. He's a big, heavy horse. And, I thought Treasure Beach was the horse to beat, and he probably relished the going the mile and a half. They knew who they had to beat, and they were trying to do that. And, he kind of tried to pop away from us, like leaving a 3.5 pole, and Johnny had to sort of pull him out and, change our tactics a little bit. And then, Treasure Beach was sort of carrying us out in the middle of the track, which probably ended up being the better part of it. So I was very impressed with the way he ran that day, just because I don't think that was his, the best scenario for him. And he seemed to come out of it good, and he's been training good. And, we're going to try to get most of our stuff done here and maybe take him to California the Monday before the Breeders' Cup and, see what happens. But I think he'll probably like that track out there being firm, and I would think he would make a good account of himself.
Is he a horse of the year candidate in your mind?
Oh, I would think so. If he were to win the Breeders' Cup, I would think definitely so.
Shug McGahey, our special guest here on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Shug, thank you very much for all your time. Best of luck along that road to the Breeders' Cup with Point of Entry. We hope you get another one. We'll be out there all week long, so we'll look forward to saying hello.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing you there too. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Shug.
Shug McGahey, the native of Lexington, Kentucky, 61 years old and inducted into Racing's Hall of Fame in 2004. Wow. Great stories. Unbelievable stuff from Shug. Looking forward to the second half of the show as well. Buff Bradley coming up here in just a couple minutes. We'll be back with Buff right after this. This is HRN Live's Final Furlong on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Listening to the Final Furlong on HRRN Live.
Hey, racing fans, don't miss your chance to check out Racing 101 from America's Best Racing. Racing 101 is a national tour visiting the country's leading racetracks to help introduce new fans to the sport and help enhance your experience at the track. Now you have the chance to learn fundamentals of the sport from the pros with one-on-one training and group seminars. Learn how to read the program, strategies for making wagers, what to look for in the paddock, how to manage your budgets, what to say at the betting window, and how to use the betting machines. And you'll have the chance to meet the stars of the sport up close with live interviews, autograph sessions, and photo opportunities. If you can't be there in person, log on to America's Best Racing at followhorseracing.com. That's followhorseracing.com.
RacehorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RacehorseReport.com. Make RacehorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RacehorseReport.com.
Attention horse players, the DRF $200 bonus is back. It's the biggest and best sign-up bonus in the business. Join DRF Bets today and get ready for Breeders' Cup with these exceptional membership benefits. Only DRF Bets members receive a free copy of DRF's game plan every weekend. It's your guide to the best betting opportunities at your favorite tracks. DRF Bets members also receive free premium wagering guides for tracks like Santa Anita and Keeneland, and for special events like the 2012 Breeders' Cup. Plus, get a free daily racing program past performances when you wager with DRF Bets. Cash in on this exclusive bonus offer and join America's most trusted wagering service today. To join DRF Bets and claim your $200 bonus, call 1-800-306-3676. That's 800-306-3676. Or visit drf.com/bets. Use promo code DRFBC200. Bet better with DRF Bets.
Don't miss your chance to participate in the biggest handicapping event of the year, the Daily Racing Form NTRA National Handicapping Championship, presented by Sovereign Stable and Treasure Island Las Vegas. To be eligible, simply log on to nhctour.com and register for just $50. Compete in handicapping tournaments throughout the country and win your seat at the NHC to be held January 13, 2013, Treasure Island in Las Vegas, where one lucky player will win an estimated $1 million and an Eclipse Award as Handicapper of the Year. Visit nhctour.com to see a complete tournament schedule and register today.
It's Trainer Talk Wednesday on the Final Furlong on HRRN Live.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, our Final Furlong show every Wednesday dedicated to talking with top trainers around the country. Of course, tomorrow, our call-in show from 6 to 7 Eastern, Sirius 93, XM 209. Make sure you tune in. Call in to talk to us about anything that's on your mind in the world of thoroughbred racing. And of course, Friday, our handicapping show from 6 to 7 as we get you ready for all the big races coming up this weekend around the country. A great interview and a great visit with Shug McGahee here in the first half of Trainer Talk this afternoon. Really looking forward to our next special guest in the second half of the show, Buff Bradley, somebody who I have known since I worked in Horse ID at Keeneland, one of the nicest guys that you're ever going to meet. He's a native of Kentucky, and he's had an awful lot of success with a very limited stable, so to speak. Not the numbers of the Steve Asmussens of the world and the Todd Pletchers, but Buff has just been incredible in what he's been able to accomplish, and it's very much a family affair, and looking forward to hearing about that. Buff, thanks for taking a little time to be with us.
Good evening, Mike. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, look, I'm not going to waste any time. I'm going to get right to Groupie Doll for a minute. We usually don't talk about the horses as much on this type of show. We get into more of the backgrounds of the trainers, but I'd be remiss if I didn't start with her because she was so brilliant this past weekend at Keeneland yet again. Talk to me about her and how she came out of the race and look back on that race.
Well, she came out of the race great. She went back to the track today and was full of herself and really looked good and moved very nicely. So we're very happy how she came out of the race. And I guess right after the race, you know, when they called me to the test point, they said, you got to come back here and see her. Kind of scared me for a minute. They said, no, don't be worried. Just come back and look at her. And she was fresh and playing and like she didn't even run. So I was so excited to see that part of it. But they about gave me a heart attack early on when they called me. But no, she came out well. The race was just, I was very excited. And I think it really meant a lot to, you know, having all of our family there and friends. And the way she did it was very impressive. And, you know, even at the top of the stretch, I'm thinking you got to get through. Don't let those horses get away before you get to chase them. So when Rajiv found that hole, when I saw her make the lead, I said, well, it's over now. And it was. She just threw away.
Oh, come on. You knew you had him the whole time. What do you mean you were nervous at the top of the stretch?
You never know that. You always, you know, I feel like she's trying to prove herself to me every time. But no, she is. Yeah, she's, I tell you what, she's loaded with a lot of talent. And just to see her do it, it's exciting every time. But I think this last win really kind of it made me think back a little bit more. I think just with her winning those races and her doing what she's done this whole year, it's been pretty special.
You know, Mike brought you in talking about the family affair, and you mentioned having the family all there at Keeneland. This is a homebred. Can you just talk about the program and what in particular led you to breeding your mare to Bowman's Band and just the genesis of Groupie Dow in general before she became who everyone knows she is?
Sure. Well, we keep about 14 mares here on our farm, and maybe don't breed every one of them every year, but we try to, you know, we try to have about 10 foals a year on the average, and we do all that ourselves. My wife Kim, she helps with the foaling. In fact, my three children help night watch until they have to go to bed. My father does the same. He's 81, but he still goes to the barn at night and sits with them, and then I take the late duty. But so we all pitch in to try to make our small operation work and foaling these mares out. And then we raise them here on the farm every year. We've got, like I said, we have about 10. And we might buy a couple at the sale every year as well. When Groupie Doll was born, it was out of a mare that we had bought at Keeneland. Didn't pay a whole lot of money for. I'm not exactly sure of the price, but we raced her, and she won a couple times at Mountaineer for us. She had some foals, nothing real special out of any of them. It's a very hard luck mare. But Groupie Doll was her last foal, and the mare was very nice, classy mare, and I said, I wish we'd get a nice, good-looking filly out of her, and we did with Groupie Doll. And I don't remember all the foals that are born there, even if I was there present, but I do remember her because she was a pretty red filly when she came out, and just big, good-looking. I know we nicknamed her Beyonce in the first day. So she was a gorgeous filly early on.
And, Buff, you mentioned your kids working around the farm and helping out and pitching in, and you're raising them very much the same way that you were raised and that you got started. Talk about that.
That's exactly right. I started at, I was 10 when we moved out to the farm and my dad built a house out there. So I was raised on the farm and grew up doing everything. We did fencing. We put up tobacco. We put in our own hay, probably why my back's not good now. we did a lot of, and that was, we operated the whole farm. We did everything on the farm that you could possibly do, plus raise horses. So I think, and train them, break them and train them. And I don't know that the horses were always the priority because you had to get everything done. They were a priority as feeding and taking care of. But as far as which one got done first, it wasn't a priority then. We've changed that part of it quite a bit, but, it's always been a good working farm, where we still do a lot of we put up our own hay. And we manage it, and it's not a real big farm, but it's a very good little working farm.
When did you first realize that you wanted to branch off and do this on your own and do this for a living?
Well, I was, when I started, I was 10, as I said, and started breaking, and I even galloped them here on the farm. We had a small track here on the farm. I went to college, and I remember telling my dad, after my last semester of college, I said, now I'm going to leave and go to the racetrack and work there. And he was a little bummed out that I wasn't going to go do something else or run his, he had a truck line at the time, and he wanted me to stay and do that. But I left in 89 and went to work for Clarence Piku. The late Clarence Piku is, who is the sire of Susie Oldham, so to speak. And people know her in the racing world, I'm sure, and married to Johnny Oldham.
Yep.
But so I worked for him for a little over 4 years, And then he kind of pushed me out and says, you've got to get on your own now. You've got big opportunities. So I worked the Midwest circuit for him, Remington, Oaklawn, Louisiana Downs, and then I worked my way back to Kentucky when I went out on my own.
Did that experience with moving around the Midwest with, sort of your mentor, so to speak, help you out in how you manage the family stable with picking spots between Mountaineer, Ellis, the Indiana tracks, et cetera?
Yeah, and I think, you know, when I went to work for Clarence, I knew I wasn't going to be in Kentucky, and I knew I wasn't going to be close to home. I wasn't anxious to leave home or the farm or my family, but I was anxious to get with a good horseman, and Clarence had trained horses for us for years, and I knew he was a very good horseman, and that's why I really wanted to get out with him and kind of move around with him and get away, and knew I would be doing that thing with him.
And Buff, you now have the opportunity to work very closely with your father, as you mentioned, Fred Bradley. I want you to talk about him for just a minute, but I grew up, my dad had his own business and I was working with him. And the only thing I can tell you is don't work with family. There were a lot of times where we butted heads and things, you know, didn't quite go according to plan, but you know, there were a lot of times when it was really great as well. Talk about your dad and talk about what it's been like, you know, having the privilege of working with him now and being part of this operation with him.
Well, I think, as you said, you can always butt heads and you've got your own opinions and everything, but I think that we've always worked through all those little things with no problem. And as I said earlier, you know, he wasn't that anxious for me to leave home and go to work on a racetrack after I just got a business degree. And he thought I should be around there and running other things and doing the farm. So, but I think soon after that, he realized that this was going to be for the best. And actually, within the first few years I got home, he bought the, when he started buying horses, he wanted to buy a couple every year and kind of build up the broodmare band again, because we had gotten down while I was gone. And I think he said, I got $10,000 to spend, so I'm going to buy two. Well, luckily, one of those two was the Dam of Brass Hat. So we got we were very lucky. And when he started, and then a few years later, he bought the Dam of Groupie Doll.
It's a nice ROI.
Right.
Well, speaking of your business degree, I have to ask, I mean, given the family nature of your stable, have you sort of thought, in terms of what Groupie Doll is worth now, is she more someone you could build a broodmare band around, or are you thinking about the November sale for her when it is time to end her racing career?
Well, I mean, I think everybody has probably thought of us as a little crazy, or probably should have sold her a long time ago. But I think if we had sold her a long time ago, we would have left a lot of money on the table. So, you know, we are in this to race, and people say, are you going to sell her in November? Well, I mean, that would probably be the smart thing to do, but we love racing, and as long as she's 100% healthy, she's going to be running, and I'm putting that out there to say that we'll more than likely be running next year if all goes well with her.
Yeah, one thing, I mean, you look at her PPs this year, she was only ahead behind Royal Delta at Gulfstream, so the form certainly holds sprinting or even going a mile in a 16th.
Yeah, and I think that really her – she's not limited on her distance, really. I mean, I think that the way she's come around and improved, I think she can, especially like a one-turn mile, I think she'd be very handy at. And, I don't know, but I know that right now we're going to keep her where we know she does well and where she is accustomed to running her style right now.
Trainer Buff Bradley joining us on this Trainer Talk edition of the Final Furlong Show here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Buff, you brought up the name Brass Hat earlier, and multimillionaire, a horse that was very, very special to you for a lot of reasons. Look back on Brass Hat, and what comes to mind now as I mention his name?
Well, people always want me to compare him. I can't really compare him. Brass Hat is a wonderful, wonderful horse, and he still is. He's part of family to us. In fact, I just rode him a few weeks ago, rode him all the way around the farm, rode him through the creek and through the woods and over top of logs, and He's really a neat horse and great to be around now. He takes, we'll turn him out with the weanlings, and he is the best babysitter with the weanlings. And so he can do anything we want here. He's still giving back to us. I mean, still giving to us. And I think he's enjoying his life now. He loved it. He was a racehorse, and probably the biggest thing that he did for myself and our family is he put us on the map. I mean, he won races everywhere, and to be able to take him around and travel with a horse of his caliber, it really kind of taught us the ropes on the big horse and what's going on. Because when you know you're sitting down and you don't have those kind of horses, then it's a different ball game. So it was fun to experience all of that with him. And you know, we bred him and raised him too, and I think that was, we soaked it all in. We thought it was special. And my father had always said, you know, we're so lucky to have a horse of this caliber, and you know, that we didn't sell him, number one. And number two, that he kept coming back from career-ending injuries. And I think that is due to a lot to my father of giving me all the time I ever needed with him. I mean, a lot of it was just, let's give him time. And he always came back really good.
For all the highs you had with him, would you say that phone call from Dubai about the DQ was one of your biggest lumps in the racing game?
It sure was. I couldn't talk for a week, and it's not a day that didn't go by that I probably don't think about that to some degree.
Yeah, I remember you know, covering it for Thoroughbred Times, and you clearly were, you know, it affected how you thought about the game, and it's a shame a horse of his caliber and natural talent you know, had to be sort of to rake through that. But I do think
right.
that the U.S. fans certainly know what he's capable of and know that came from his heart and general ability and not anything else.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, and he came back, I think, another, you know, he was a hard-knocking horse. And he went to battle every time. And I think his probably another memorial win for us was probably when he won the Sycamore at age 9 at Keeneland. And it was, I still don't know how he won that race. And Calvin brought him through traffic, and I mean, he just mowed him down, and it was, that was pretty nice too.
Buff Bradley talking with us here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Of course, Brass Hat, Groupie Doll, among his most prominent runners that he's ever sent to the post. Buff, do you have a horse looking back that you would say, man, I'd like to get one more crack with that one? I wish I had that one back. This horse could have been really, really special. Is there kind of that one horse that maybe got away?
Well, I might think of a few. not, you know, I just, you think that, you know, I think there are some, but I don't dwell on that. I really always look forward, and I think, you know, we look at these young horses that we raise every year, and it's always, I've got another owner that has a few foals every year, and he said, this is the best one yet, and Jack Reese, and I agree with him all the time, and he's got such a great attitude to say, this is the one, or this is the best one yet, and Jack says that all the time, and I love that, because that's what I think, too. You know, with a lot of my stable is made up of homebreds from a few different owners, and, you know, so it's, they know that I'm thinking their way, because we want to get black type on some of those horses, and we want to, you know, we want to try to make them winners wherever we might need to run them, you know, and so we try to get the best out of that horse to help make the mare as well.
Hey, where'd the name Buff come from? Where'd that nickname come from?
My brother named me that when I was little, and when I was little, he started calling me Buffalo Bill, riding horses around all the time when I was little. So it stuck. Buffalo Bill stuck and got shortened to Buff.
Did you have your little cowboy hat on and everything when you were riding them?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Boots and cowboy hat.
So what's the plan now? You know, we're a little more than 3 weeks out for the Breeders' Cup. Have you decided when you're going to ship and just how you're going to bring Groupie Doll up to the Filly and Mare Sprint?
Well, we're going to ship her out, I think, about a week early. The plane leaves. And so we're going to try to get on the first plane that's in that time frame to get out there and get her acclimated. She is a very, very good shipper. Anything we do with her, she has a lot of class. We ship her into a barn. It could be a new barn, and she'll lay down in the first hour or two and rest. And nothing stirs her up too much.
Have you run in California before?
I've never run in California. Okay. I went there for the last Breeders' Cup. I think the last Breeders' Cup that they had there. It's when they had the fires. It may have been the one before, but yeah. I've been out there to see it from the front side.
Buffy, you had the privilege of being around so many nice horses. You mentioned Clarence Piku and working with Clarence, and yeah, you were around some really nice horses there. Does she, Groupie Doll, remind you of any other horse that you've been around, or is she completely unique?
No, she's completely unique, really. And I have to say the same for Brass Hat. They were both very unique. They have similarities that they both show their class and both stop and look. And I try to pay attention to those qualities and see if I've got any standing out here in my field right now, just to make sure. But no, she's pretty unique. I have been around some nice horses, and the good horses are you love to be around them and see what they can do. I can't really say that Groupie Doll is like any of the others.
Yeah, talk about some of the other horses that you've been around that really hold a special place in your heart for one reason or another. But talk about some of those other horses outside of Groupie Doll and Brass Hat.
Well, we've had some homebreds that were stakes horses, and then a few that we bought. Town Queen is one that we bred and raised, and King of Speed, he won over $500,000. We had several out of one mare that really, even if they gotten claimed from us later on, we always followed them. And in fact, King of Speed, he won over 20-something times, made close to $600,000. And once so he'd gotten claimed from us, probably at age 7 or 8, and still won the next couple of years and did very well for Brad Calhoun. And in fact, we ended up getting him back once he was retired and used him as a riding horse and a pony horse at the track as well. But he's won. And then Town Queen, as I said, that was the first stakes winner that we bred, and she made $250,000. She was a nice filly. The one when I worked with Clarence Piku, the biggest one was Free Spirit's Joy, a Louisiana bred that won the Louisiana Derby, or the Super Derby, in 1991 and beat Best Pal and Olympio and Light. And that was a special time, and Calvin Burrell rode him. So we were very close friends, and from that time on.
You know, Buff, I know training horses is not necessarily the easiest of gigs, and there's a lot of sacrifice involved, not just from you, but from your family members as well. And we talked about your dad and your relationship there and working with him now and being able to work so closely, but your wife, Kim, your children, talk about them and how they played a role and their support that they've showed you and how they've kind of helped you along the road in your career.
Sure. Well, Kim helps run the farm and manage the farm. And I know that whatever's being done at the farm, she relates to me quite frequently throughout the day. So we know exactly what's going on with our layups at the farm and our young horses at the farm. All three of my children have work on the farm to some degree. It might be on a Sunday or a weekend or a fall break like right now. And my oldest, who is a senior in high school, she worked this past summer. She went with me every day to Churchill to cool out horses. And I was brought up this way, as working on the farm, it's hard work, but you know to appreciate it. I do pay them. Don't overwork them, so I don't want the child labor all to get me in trouble. But I don't, they learn a responsibility, and they know that they have to be at work on time. If I say be there at 8 o'clock in the morning, be there at 8 o'clock in the morning. If you come in at 5 minutes after 8, you're not getting paid that day, but you're going to work. And they really do well. And I trying to teach them a responsibility, plus they're able to earn their own money and able to go buy their own things sometimes. So, but they do appreciate the farm. They understand, you know, the whole concept of why we do this. And I'll tell you a quick story about when my son Drew was 8 or 9 years old, and he's 13 now. He, you know, a few years back, he told me when we just fold the mare out, and the foal's still laying there, and the mare's reaching around trying to lick it and everything. And I remember it so clearly. Drew looks at me and says, "You never know, Dad, this could be another brass hat." And, you know, right there, I'll never forget that, because it kind of set it all for me. You know, we do this because we love it. We love to see the horses run, but you never know when you might have that special horse as well. And, you know, we see reality where we still have to run a $5,000 horse, and there's still my father and I are the same way. We can still, if we win a race, and if it's Melmer's a 2 for $7,500, we're still pretty excited. We get excited. And, you know, it's a great game, great to watch a homebred win. You know that you put a lot of work in it. And I think that my children are able to see that. And so I think that's a big part of it.
You mentioned, you know, whether it's on the lower end of racing or the higher end, that Groupie Dollar Brass Hat have taken you to. Kentucky obviously has all ranges. Have you given any thought in terms of the calendar? A lot of chatter this year about Turfway and its September dates. Where would you like to see the state of Kentucky go in terms of the racing calendar?
Well, Kentucky has been hurting for quite some time, for several years. I stayed at Turfway for many years. This will be my fourth year that I'll travel to Florida for the wintertime. And I hate to do it. I hate to leave my family and farm behind, you know, because we are set up here, and it's very convenient for me as a trainer to be able to send my horses back to the farm if they need 2 or 3 weeks. So, you know, I really would like to see Kentucky get back with it. I don't know the answer. I know that we need to get better purses. I don't know how we go about getting everything done, because it's not been done so far. I've seen a lot of surrounding states that have done it and the way that they've done it, but are they going to last is what I wonder too. But I see a lot of people leaving here, and it's, that part is really sad. And for where our home base is, I do worry about that, here in Kentucky. But, you know, I know that there's a lot of good organizations that our keep is really trying to stay on top of it. I think they're a very good organization on trying to help bring back the breeding and racing here, because I've seen a lot of breeding leave here as well.
Yeah, it's a shame that most people think of, you know, all these high-end people or who run the game, but, I mean, you're a perfect example. It's a family affair. It's farming. It's agriculture. And you put money back not only into the sport but the state.
Absolutely. And it is. My stable, it'll consist of, I've got Maiden 7500s in my stable right now, and I've probably got a few more that are still haven't got to me yet that are going to be that way. And it's nice to be able to have, say, the brass hats or the groupie dolls, and one in your stable that can kind of help carry you along. But our stable runs all the way through from the condition claimers all the way up to allowance and then one good horse. But, you know, I think there's a lot of people here in this state that are in the same boat that I am. They really are, and that will have horses all the way across the board that they need to run. And you'll see that from people at Churchill. They're taking their horses to Indiana to race or to Pennsylvania to race, and they'll make a long ship just to do that. When I'm in Kentucky, I've only gone out of the state of Kentucky twice since I've been back from Florida, since the 1st of April. I've only run outside the state twice, and I ran once at Indiana and once at Presque Isle. Presque Isle was a good one.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of those was for $400,000. So.
That worked out good. And the nice thing is, Buff, only about a minute left here before we have to get to the end of the show here, but the nice thing is, for the next few weeks, we get to forget about all that and move toward the Breeders' Cup. And can't wait to watch you move forward out there to Santa Anita. We'll be there all week long and looking forward to catching up with you there. And really appreciate you taking some time to spend with us here tonight. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you all so much. Yeah, thank you. Buff.
Best of luck.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah, all the best, Buff. Right. Good luck. Thank you.
Thank you.
Trainer Buff Bradley, great story, and we could have spent a lot more time with Buff there.
Shug and a Buff, all in 1 hour.
Shug and a Buff, I like that. There you go. Not Shug in the Buff.
Or
Shug and a Buff, right?
Yeah, Shug and a Buff.
Okay, all right, let's make sure we get that straight. Our thanks to all of our special guests who joined us here today. Chad Brown, Pete Rotundo, and of course our producer, Lee Delapina. Ed DeRosa, great job filling in, my friend.
That was a lot of fun. Anytime.
Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you tomorrow here on HRN.